And welcome back to Coast, final hour to go. We'll take your phone calls. Matthew Alper with us, the God part of the brain. Okay, welcome back. Matthew Alper with us. We're going to get to your calls in just a second as they begin to flood in. Matthew, what's your next project, by the way?
Well, actually, as I mentioned earlier, that book Icarus of Brooklyn is going to become a film. I've been working on the screenplay. So my first writing, I used to be a high school history teacher, and I bought a book, How to Write a Screenplay, and my first writing was a science fiction script that I sold to a European film company that got produced in Germany. And then I came up with the idea of the God part of the brain and realized that that was kind of my calling. So I came back to New York and I spent time writing the book. But in the last couple of years, I decided that I kind of missed the screenwriting thing.
Good for you.
So, so I've been working on the script for Icarus, which, like I said, is going to be made into a movie.
When do you think we'll see it? And what's the venue? Big screen or DVDs?
No. Big screen. Probably more on the indie side. It's not going to be like a huge major motion picture, but it will be in the indie circuit, you know, Sundance, etc. And probably going to start production in about like 6 months or so.
Good for you. Now, with the God part of the brain, have you been confronted by theologians? And if so, what do they say to you?
Congratulations for putting together such a tremendous book. And even though I might not necessarily agree, they tell me that, you know, you put together a really compelling hypothesis, which makes believers and non-believers alike really think.
Well, let me ask you this, because we know now that you do not believe in God, quote unquote. Do you think that there is some kind of force out there, though, that could be responsible, whatever it is, for this creation? I mean, in terms of getting it to work and putting it together and, you know, here are these stars and here are these planets. Did something, whether it's consciousness or intelligence, do you think something did it?
No, I don't think that there was like a mind behind the creation of the universe.
So you think it was just a fluke?
For lack of a better word, sure, a fluke.
I just think there's so much here that makes sense.
Right,
there's a lot
again,
that doesn't make sense,
It's our tendency to project order. And there is order, you know, the mechanics of how atoms work, how molecules form, all of it seems so structured that it's our nature to project an order onto that. And when we see order, we look for the orderer. Again, it's our nature. But I don't believe that there's a conscious being that, you know, sort of sought out and said, I'm going to do it this way, and I'm going to make atoms do this. I'm going to put them together with electrons and neutrons and protons, and then they're going to bond in certain ways, and the universe is going to unfold in a specific way. I don't believe in any type of spiritual reality. I think that the universe is a physical phenomena devoid of an intelligent designer, and that's it.
Amazing. Okay, let's go back to the calls. Ken in Wilmington, Delaware, welcome to the show. Hi, Ken, go ahead.
Good morning, George. How are you?
Hi, good.
Good. And your guest? Hello, sir. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for calling.
That's great. All right, you were talking about claims about the afterlife and seeing spirits and all kind of stuff like that. Well, it's kind of like irrelevant. I don't care particularly if you believe me or not, but my grandparents' house, we lived in, my family and I, and I saw my granny, and she died when I was 3 years old, and I saw her when I was 15, scared the heck out of me. And I'm not the only one that saw her. So, unless there's some kind of electrical energy going on in that house, there was something there. I mean, my mother's cat, every time she will, at nighttime, that cat, the hair would go on the back of its neck, and that sucker would take off, you know, for high hills. And, seeing things like that is a hard time. It causes a hard to not believe that there is life after death, or that there's spirits, or there is something going on afterwards. I mean, we don't just kick the bucket and turn it into a blip.
Okay, well, again, people have been reporting from the beginning of time, seeing spirits, et cetera, sort of similar to what you describe. But again, from a personal perspective, being someone who, you know, prescribes to sort of the ways of science, being that scientists have been out there trying to verify and validate the notion of spirits, ghosts, you know, apparitions, et cetera. And, you know, these are some smart people who put men on the moon, who developed the computer and every other technology and medicine that we possess, have yet to find one shred of evidence to suggest that ghosts are real. So I'm not going to try to contradict what you believe you saw, but I'm just going to say from a scientific perspective, you know, if one goes to college and they decide, I'm going to study one of the sciences, you can pick many disciplines, geology, physics, biology, molecular science. There's no science called, you know, apparitional science, the science of ghosts, because no scientists have ever validated the existence of one.
Matthew, how come science can't even give us rational explanations about how all this formed? I mean, they talk about a Big Bang theory. That's unacceptable to me because they really don't explain much.
Well, the Big Bang, I mean, really, there's a lot of physicists out there, really intelligent people. Again, people who've, you know, put us in space, created the Hubble telescope, all of these amazing things with the use of their, you know, abilities in math and science. And it's those same people who pretty much unanimously agree that the Big Bang theory works, makes sense, that there's so much evidence that that's the case. The thing is with the Big Bang theory is it suggests that the universe is about 13 billion years old, but that there are prior universes because according to Big Bang, the universe erupted 13 billion years ago, is now expanding, but eventually will stop expanding and then will begin to contract until the whole universe is condensed into one singular point yet again, and then it goes into another Big Bang. So essentially, based on what scientists believe, the universe is sort of like a pulse in space, going through a series of explosions, expansions, and contractions, you know, however many, every, you know, 50 billion years or so. So even if we could use like radar technology to look back in time to the Big Bang, the thing is we will never know what happened in the last universe before the Big Bang, because that's now all gone.
There could have been many.
Well, there's probably been an infinite series because time is endless. So, you know, not only does time extend into the future forever, but it extends into the past forever as well. So, again, it's a hard concept to wrap our brains around, the notion of forever going both directions. But, you know, the universe has pretty much been around forever and will be around forever. So even among scientists, we can only go back to the last Big Bang, to the last time that the universe was condensed into a point and then erupted into an eruption of energy and matter, which led to formations of basically hydrogen atoms, which then became huge clouds, which became stars, which became furnaces that gave birth to different types of matter, and ergo the universe as we have it today. But unfortunately, we'll never be able to look beyond the Big Bang of this particular universe. Again, for me, that doesn't suggest proof of a higher power. It just means that, as you called it, a fluke, that the universe exists for whatever reason. And I don't think we'll ever know that answer.
You seem to have adapted. You seem to have accepted the fact that, in your opinion, there is no God, there is no life after death. But what would happen to most people, Matthew, if they felt the same way, if they were all atheists instantly? Mm-hmm. Would they be able to handle it?
I don't think it's even possible for the human brain to for us to suddenly just take away spirituality and religion from the human race. First of all, again, it evolved for a reason, for humans to cope with existential anxiety, which we will suffer till the end of time, or basically until we become such a dysfunctional animal that we destroy ourselves. But in like certain experiments, like nations like China, for instance, where they try to outlaw religion and spirituality and replace it with, you know, the institution of government, so that basically government becomes your religion. Even there, where religion is outlawed, it's not to say that everyone suddenly became an atheist. Now, by, you know, official Chinese doctrine, they are an atheist nation. Nevertheless, they've suppressed religion, but what's come of it is you end up with some of the most superstitious people on earth. So basically they have beliefs in everything from numerology to all sorts of holistic notions that, like, you know, shark fin will make you live forever. So you can't erase. It's an instinct. It'd be like telling a culture, like, you know, you can't ever have music again. Music is banished. It's evil. It's bad. You can't think musically. People will be humming in their heads. It's just part of our nature. So we'll never eradicate religion. But for nations that try, it, all that ends up happening is people end up just believing in various superstitions or, you know, sort of replacement paradigms that allow us to still believe that there's something else out there.
Let's go to Chuck in Blountville, Tennessee. Hi, Chuck. You're up with
George,
us.
How you doing, brother? Good. I love you, man.
Thank you.
I guess that's just one of the frailties of the human mind, just loving each other, but that's me. Matthew, I would love to sit down and talk to you. I could sit down and talk to you all night long. But,
well, you're sitting and talking to me right now, so.
Yeah.
There you go.
I want you to, I'm going to concede on a couple of your points, and basically, I'm going to concede to the point that the human brain has a tendency, has a need, is wired to explain the unexplainable and to control the uncontrollable. I think that's basically what you've been saying.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll concede to those points, but I'm going to use the Big Bang Theory as an example. It's an accepted theory that Big Bang Theory happened. And that's how the universe came into being, correct?
That's how this particular universe came into being.
But scientifically speaking, we cannot prove or disprove that. Is that correct?
No, we can prove the Big Bang.
No, we cannot. We cannot prove anything because we weren't there. 14 billion years ago, there was no one there to...
This is the thing. Stars and things that happen in space leave trails. And scientists, just like, for instance, when we look up at the sky at night and we see stars, a lot of those stars don't exist anymore. What we're seeing is the light that was projected that travels at the speed of light. But many of those stars supernovaed billions of years ago. They don't exist. But because we have instruments that can detect energies out in space, we can read things that no longer exist. Just like our eyes pick up the light of stars that might no longer exist. So we have instruments that pick up, you know, that basically can read the past. And and I'm not a physicist. So, you know, I would not be the best person to, you know, sort of inform you in that science. But I've read a lot of physics books, and I know that the people who write about it know what they're talking about, and they possess instruments that allow us to look back in time to read measurements of basically sort of lost stars and the formation of stars and things that have happened way in the past, all the way back to 13 billion years. And a lot of that science is what takes place in these, you know, these nuclear accelerators, these particle accelerators like CERN, where they can sort of explode atoms, and through studying these explosions of atoms, you know, basically can surmise things that have happened in the past in our physical universe. So it's not just like conjecture. Someone said, hey, here's kind of an interesting concept. Let's go with this. Scientists don't just go with things. The only reason that the Big Bang is such an accepted theory is because there's volumes of data that validate that theory. Now, again, I am not an astrophysicist, so unfortunately, I wouldn't be the guy to have on that show to ask that question. But there are people who could answer that, and people like you and I might not even know what they're talking about, but they know what they're talking about.
Matthew, I have never gotten a great answer explaining the Big Bang from any scientist who has ever been on this program.
Well, I think you need to look harder. Go to like Stanford University and find an astrophysicist.
They can't explain it.
I'd have to believe that you haven't spoken to the right guy yet. Or woman. I don't want to be chauvinistic here.
I mean, no one can tell me how something was created from nothing.
Right. Well, that's a different question. The Big Bang really just takes from the first particulate, you know, singularity, and then goes through. I mean, they can go back to like the first nanosecond of the universe. So basically, they can read things out in space that suggest like the first matter forming. And again, that's what they're discovering in these nuclear accelerators when they bombard atoms together, and they can see those first quantum particles sort of merge from raw energy into matter. Because as Einstein taught us, equals mc squared, energy and matter are one and the same. That basically, you know, matter is energy accelerated at the speed of light squared. So at the beginning of the explosion, you had raw energy. And the minute that energy began to slow down, it sort of basically took on the form of matter. And as it slowed down a little bit more, again, we're talking about within the first milliseconds of the universe, it began to form into quantum particles, which then became electrons, neutrons, and protons, which then bonded into hydrogen atoms. And the first matter in space was just hydrogen. That's all we had. And for the first few billion years, the universe was just made up of hydrogen clouds, which again converged into the first stars, which became furnaces, which began, you know, through nuclear fission and fusion, began forging other elements.
All right. Hold on for a second, Matthew. We're at the break, but we'll come back and wrap things up with final calls. Okay, welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Dory with you, along with Matthew Alper, as we talk about his book, The God Part of the Brain, and your questions. Let's go to questions now, Matthew. We've got so many people lining up, and the clock is ticking for us. Did you want to wrap up what you were saying? Or are you okay on that?
No, I think I'm wrapped up. I also just want to add that I just checked my email, and there was a whole string of emails from very respectful listeners who a lot of the subject was, this is not hate mail. And I just want to say hats off to your audience.
Good.
For sharing the love and respect in those emails that I just read.
Perfect. Let us go next to Zach in Clyde, Texas. Good morning, Zach. Go ahead.
Morning, George. It's actually evening for me and also Matthew.
Thank Alrighty.
You guys for taking my call.
Sure thing.
Really quick, I briefly give you some background on myself, which will context my question. I served in the Marine Corps 4 years, combat veteran, 2003, Operation Iraqi Freedom, Shock and Awe, the Task Force Tarawa. I'm currently a police officer. I've been serving for 9 years.
Thank
I've done
you.
Over half of my career in as a deputy sheriff in the 15th largest county in the United States, here in Texas.
Awesome.
In between, I got a bachelor's of science in psychology with an associate of science in sociology. So. Matthew, your premise is absolutely fascinating to me. Even being a fairly actively serving Jewish member of my temple community here.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my question deals with not near-death experiences, but something I've experienced both in my career and personally. Near-death experiences, which you may have touched on, and
It's a chapter in my book, so yeah. But go on.
I may have missed that part of the show because actually I'm on duty.
We didn't get to cover that, but that's
in.
Okay.
Those, I think 99% of them just using analytical skills as a police officer can be debunked. But I've had instances where, and they're few and far between, but we've had people that we've loaded onto the bus, we're taking them down to county hospital, and they die. They flatline. There's no signs of brain activity. You know, at this point, we're just waiting to get to the hospital for the doctor to pronounce. And all of a sudden, they come back. In fact, something similar happened to me. I'm a cancer survivor. I had Hodgkin's lymphoma. And May 15th of 2012, I had to have a bone marrow transplant. I died three times in the hospital. There's one incident in ICU where it was 2.5 minutes. They were waiting. The nursing staff and my family was waiting for the doctor to come down, get free to be able to pronounce me. And I guess all of a sudden I just woke up. I looked around the room and I was like, what the expletive deleted are you guys all staring at me for? Like I just came back from the dead. And every single person, and again, this is very few and far between, has had some sort of an afterlife experience. And I'm wondering, from your perspective as a scientist, mm-hmm. what you think could be the cause of that if there is no afterlife.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense. And like I said, it's why I felt it was important to have a chapter in my book called Near-Death Experiences, where I look at it from a scientific perspective. Now, they've done studies on near-death experiences, and basically they're connected to a neurotransmitter called glutamate. When the brain gets a decreased oxygen flow, the brain secretes glutamate. So for instance, your heart stops or you're bleeding out, so your brain's not getting its normal oxygen supply, the brain secretes this neurotransmitter, and the effects of that neurotransmitter, there are several. One is it triggers the optic nerve to flare, so we tend to see this bright light. It also basically triggers the temporal lobe, which is where they find religious experience comes from. When they put people in MRIs while they're having a religious experience, that's one of the parts of the brain that seems to light up. And they found that, like, during a near-death experience, what happens is glutamate activates the temporal lobe. So we tend to have, and what it does is it also slows the heart rate down. So the idea is that if you're bleeding out, for instance, you're going to be bleeding less. It's also meant to calm you so that instead of panicking while one is dying, which isn't going to do you any good, it relaxes you. You have a sense of euphoria. As far as dying, I don't believe, at least according to the medical community, anyone has ever died and come back. Now, the heart stops. We flatline. So basically, your heart's just a pump. It's not you. So a heart can stop, and it could stop for a few minutes even, and a person could still continue to be alive. I mean, until your brain is dead, you're alive. So people flatline, their heart stops, there's no register on a meter of the heart beating, but that doesn't make us dead. That just means the pump stopped pumping. But it takes about 5 to 7 minutes for the cells in the body to die, but without receiving any oxygen supply. So the heart could stop for 2, 3 minutes, 4 minutes, and eventually some people will suffer brain damage if we're not getting oxygen for too long, but even 2 or 3 minutes we can survive, and suddenly the heart starts pumping again, we're revived, and we were never technically dead. Now, nobody, at least by standards of science, nobody whose brain ever died, so they suffered clinical brain death, ever came back and had a conscious experience after that, which is why so many families pull the plug on people who have comas. So as far as near-death experiences, the thing that would make me the most skeptical is, again, it's a human phenomena that's been reported by every culture and every religion. So if we go to the jungles of Africa or the Middle East or any culture with a different religion, people have near-death experiences, report this notion of they saw white light, they felt they were going through a tunnel, they felt that they saw the pearly gates of whatever their religion's heaven is. But the thing is, we're all seeing different things. So again, whereas the Muslim says, Like, I know I had a religious experience because I saw a white light and then I was greeted by Muhammad. And then a Christian might say, I saw at the end of the tunnel, I saw the pearly gates, or I saw Jesus or Mary waiting for me. So it would make me wonder, is this just a neurophysiological phenomena meant to sort of comfort us while we're losing blood or our heart has stopped, and sort of slow our heart rate down and give us a better chance of survival? Or are we actually going to some other side and seeing our gods? The only thing is, since we're all seeing different gods, again, either only one of us is right and everyone else is having a hallucination, or we're all having the same hallucination.
Matthew, have you ever had what we would call a paranormal experience?
You know, when I was a teenager, I used to have what is referred to as out-of-body experiences.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay.
But, again, I believe that, and they've done physiological studies, things like there are people who suffer something, Cotard syndrome, or people who have phantom limb syndromes, where you can feel like your body is moving without you. So I used to have, you know, again, not... when I say out-of-body experiences, I'm putting it in quotes. I don't feel like I ever actually traveled out of my body. Nice thought. I wish I could. But when I was a teenager, I remember having certain lucid dreaming where in my sleep, I felt like I was sitting up in bed. I felt like sounds I were hearing were as real as what feels real to me right now. And I was very curious. It was part of what actually prompted me to think, maybe there is something else going on here. But again, now that I've researched the brain more and I discuss out-of-body experiences from a neurophysiological perspective in my book, it seems to be a type of hallucination, again, universally described by every culture, where we feel like our bodies are somehow moving without us while we're lying without moving at all. And again, it's in many ways akin to like a phantom limb experience, where the brain is telling us that our arms are moving. And this is reported by people, for instance, who lost their limbs in war or other things, so they don't even have their arms anymore, but they could swear that they felt their arm moving around. And it's a type of hallucination that the brain creates. And again, what the brain tells us, we believe, because perception is reality.
Sure. Let's go to Lyman in Richmond, Virginia. Hello, Lyman. Go ahead.
Hello. Hello again. I just want to say this is a fascinating discussion.
Well, thank you.
Matthew, and,
thank you, Lyman.
Yeah. My position is that the real reason for religion is because we're in an existence that has been set up by some force, who knows, in which somebody or something has to die so something else can live. It's tragic, but it does exist. And this creates a terrifying aspect to everybody, I think, subconsciously at least, in which we hope that there's a God who cares, but we cannot be assured of that. What is your opinion on a God that might possibly care?
Well, I guess it would be the same opinion I might have on a God who doesn't care, which is I wouldn't believe in one either way. So, you know, whether a religion presents itself as having a more wrathful, vindictive God, which most religions do, because whatever religion you talk about, there's some version of heaven and hell. So the mere fact that every religion has incorporated hell into their system means that, you know, God's got a little bit of a vindictive spirit. If you cross him or break his laws, you'll be punished badly and forevermore without any chance of redemption. So, you know, but at the same time, religions like to say, well, but our God is a loving, caring God, because people need that comfort. But again, from an atheist perspective who doesn't believe in a God, period, my feelings on a caring God would be the same as it would on a hateful God, which is I don't believe in one.
Mike in Cleveland, Ohio. Hey, Michael, go ahead.
Good evening, George and Matthew.
Hi there.
A comment and a question, please.
Sure.
My comment is Barry Long said that in the late 80s, that when we identified that death happens to us personally, we created the hope for tomorrow to mentally project ourselves into, which I call that, the original religion. So, Matthew, in reading Rick Strassman's book, DMT, The Spirit Molecule, who's been on Coast to Coast several times, mm-hmm. and in my experience, it seems like there is a lack of cultural reference or influence on these seemingly DMT-induced experiences, that they are very bizarre and unreferenced to one's personal experience. So in leaving no stone unturned, sir, have you ever done DMT or the ayahuasca brew to see if there seems any credibility to the report in Dr. Strassman's book that these are genuine spiritual experiences?
Well, I've never done DMT or ayahuasca, but, and again, this book that I've written, Icarus of Brooklyn, a part of that has to do with my exploration with drugs in my attempt to seek transcendence. So even though I didn't do those drugs, I did similar psychedelics, whereas I did shrooms, mm-hmm. LSD, mescaline, and peyote. And all told, I did those about 10 to 15 times, each time in search of transcendence, hoping that I would experience something that made me confident that there was a spiritual realm. Now, from my perspective, all I had were altered states of consciousness, which, as compelling as they were, and as tempting as it might have been to come to the conclusion that I had passed on to some higher plane, again, skeptic that I am, I felt that really I couldn't say with any certainty that I had anything other than a altered state of consciousness, which is what I believe those drugs do, because really all they do is they tamper with your neurotransmitters. And when your neurotransmitters are tampered with, consciousness and perception is tampered with. So neurotransmitters, again, from a scientific perspective, don't tamper with your spirit, they tamper with your brain. And when your brain, you know, start seeing things, hearing things, having these altered states, and given that I'm, as I suggest in the God part of the brain, that we're already inherently compelled to believe in some form of a transcendental reality, when we're having an altered state of consciousness, it tends to be our instinct to project that belief onto those altered states and to then believe that we feel that we've transcended somehow. From my perspective, I would say none of that is true or real, but that's just, again, a perception, but that as far as have we actually gone to some other side, I would retain my skeptical belief that no, we have not.
What would you ask the Pope or the Dalai Lama if you had an audience with them, Matthew?
Well, I might ask the Pope something like, why have you been protecting pedophile priests for the last 100 years? Or something more to the extent of, why are you telling people that they shouldn't use, for instance, condoms, like in continents like Africa, where AIDS is rampant, where basically telling people not to use birth control seems to be the equivalent to me of something more like genocide. As far as the Dalai Lama, I don't know. I might ask his favorite ice cream flavor. He seems like a nice, mellow guy who's preaching peace and love, but I don't know if I'd have any real questions for him.
Next up, let's go to David in Georgia. Hey, David, let's squeeze you in here.
Oh, how y'all doing tonight?
Good, Dave.
Matthew, your theory there on the God part of the brain just answered a couple of very serious questions for me. One, why are there so many different religions, and why do they want to continuously kill each other? And then it dawned on me, maybe this is a natural selection part of the brain, like every other species has, to control its population so it doesn't become overpopulated, and that justifies us killing each other to keep the population down.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a good question, and it's a fair question. But I believe that, first of all, the reason we created so many gods is just like it's a cultural reality. So, for instance, humans are a linguistic animal. We're wired to create language. And because we're culturally separated from another, we come up with different words. So we've got French and English and Russian. Every culture comes up with its different, with its own unique language. Similarly, every culture's come up sort of with its own mythology. It's created its own tales, its own gods. Now, when humans first evolved, we weren't populated the way we are today. We lived in small nomadic tribes that rarely crossed paths. So it wasn't necessarily a weeding. It wasn't necessarily, you know, meant to sort of weed off the species. But there is this tribal instinct we have where basically when the population started to grow and cultures started to overlap upon one another, it became a problem because suddenly different belief systems were merging into one another, and there's no way that your God could be real and my God could be real at the same time, which has led to tribal warfare.
Matthew, thank you for being on the program, The God Part of the Brain. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, and George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.